Jeb Bush says he's forming a political action committee and will explore a run for the presidency. This hour, how that announcement has shaken up the political landscape. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we talk about Jeb Bush's strengths and weaknesses as a candidate and a look at his prospects here in Iowa. Also, how parties not only determine who will win the nomination, but how they also shape the primary field. And we look at the legacies of Iowa's retiring members of Congress. Our analysts today, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa and Hans Hassel of Cornell College. Join our discussion for Politics Day. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and it's Politics Wednesday once again as we end the session of this Congress. I want to talk a little bit about that a little later on with our guests, political analysts, Donna Hoffman, department head and associate professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa in our Cedar Falls studio. Hello, Donna.
Hi, Ben.
Hans Hassel is with us, assistant professor of politics at Cornell College, joining us in our Iowa City studio. You've been with us once before. Hans, welcome back.
It's great to be here.
And, of course, we want to spend quite a bit of time talking about the major political news of the week, which happened yesterday, and we'd like to have you join our conversation. Yesterday, Jeb Bush shook up the still early 2016 presidential race by announcing he would form a political action committee, allowing him to explore a possible White House bid. In posts on Twitter and his Facebook page, the son and younger brother of former presidents wrote, "The PAC's purposes will be to support leaders, ideas, and policies that will expand opportunity and prosperity for all Americans. In the coming months, I hope to visit with many of you and have a conversation about restoring the promise of America." Now, yesterday, Governor Branstad, after hearing that, reacted to former Florida governor's intention to run for the Republican nomination. He says he was surprised Bush was announcing so early and recalled the fundraiser Bush held for him last May.
You know, I have a lot of respect for him and the job that he did as governor. But, you know, I also have a lot of respect for Governor Christie and Governor Jindal and former Governor Huckabee and Governor of Texas, Governor Perry.
Governor Branstad, yesterday, want to reach out to you, especially in this first half hour. Tell us your reaction to Jeb Bush's announcement that he will explore a run for the presidency. Can you imagine another, a third President Bush? 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Donna Hoffman, Governor Branstad saying he was surprised it was announced so early. Did that surprise you as well?
Well, not really. I mean, we've known for a long time that he's at least, that Bush has at least been thinking about it. And, you know, really, what did he say? He said he's actively considering, I think were the exact words that he tweeted out. Or actively exploring, I think that was it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that steps it up one level. He didn't form an exploratory committee. I mean, there's a little bit of difference there in terms of how money is counted in that. But, you know, he's certainly looking at the race and has been for a number of months, I think. And, you know, by using social media to put out that he's actively exploring this, he obviously made news. And, you know, if in 3 months from now he wants to then announce he's forming an exploratory committee, he'll make news again, maybe not as much. But mm-hmm. Nevertheless, it certainly is something in which he can say, here I am, I'm looking at it. And there's another reason behind that, in that he wants to signal to other people who are also considering running in the Republican field that he's, you know, at least looking to talk with donors and to try to see where donors stand and if they'll stand with him. And get started on what we call the invisible primary.
Mm-hmm. Hans, what do you see as this representing in addition to that? Or
I think he's trying to push up the schedule a little bit. One of the quotes that I saw in relation to this was a funder who was saying that now that he's entered the ring, he's trying to push everybody to commit now, and because having those funders on as part of your campaign makes a huge difference in your viability. in the reputation you get, and it allows you to access a huge network of political fundraisers that will be very beneficial to the campaign. And I think he's just trying to get a jump on that.
Mm-hmm. So the deal is with the primary that you want to get the deep pockets out there in the GOP. You want to signal them, as you said, Donna, and the sooner you can get that money behind you, the better, Hans?
Exactly. Yeah. There's been recent research that has shown that candidates who are able to consolidate the party's key network behind them are much more viable in primary electoral contests. And so I think he's trying to consolidate that network quickly while others are still kind of racing to try to put together staff. He's trying to basically say, here I am. I'm established this. I'm considering this. Come join my team. I'm going to be a viable candidate.
Mm-hmm. And also, I might add, at the same time in doing that, he does put pressure on other people who we consider to be more establishment Republican types, like Mitt Romney, who we've heard is potentially considering another run, Chris Christie. They're all going to be fighting for the same donors, the same elites in the party, and he puts pressure on them in announcing this early.
Jeb Bush, certainly someone with a great deal of name recognition as part of one of our currently two political dynasties. Donna Hoffman, how do you size him all up otherwise as in terms of strengths and weaknesses? I guess we don't know whether the Bush name is a strength or a weakness, do we?
I think it's both. I mean, certainly it gives him some name recognition. It can also be a drag because there can be what we might think of as Bush fatigue in terms of voters. But Jeb Bush, you know, has a political career in his own right. He was a successful two-term governor of Florida, and he has both strengths. I mean, like all candidates, he has both strengths and weaknesses, and the name Bush ends up being both of those things for him.
Mm-hmm. A couple weeks ago, at the beginning of the month, Charlie Cook was on this program, one of the most respected political experts in the country, founder and editor of the Cook Political Report. And this is, of course, before Jeb Bush had announced this. But we were talking about the prospect of Jeb Bush possibly being a candidate. And I wanted to have the two of you listen to what he said, see if you agree with how he sizes up Jeb Bush as a candidate, especially in Iowa.
He's got to run against the grain of his own party. He's got to be chasing after a nomination that's somewhat headed the other way. I mean, when you think about 2012 and think about people starting with the Iowa Republican straw poll in August of 2011, think about people who at various points along the way were front runners for the Republican nomination. You know, from right to left, roughly, Michelle Bachmann, Herman Cain, Rick Santorum, Newt Gingrich. Only now do we get to Rick Perry. They never even looked at Tim Pawlenty, never looked at John Huntsman, and only went with Mitt Romney, the guy that I thought they would initially go to. They only went to Romney as a last resort when all the other candidates were effectively dead, where they clearly wanted a nominee that was a lot more conservative than Mitt Romney. So if you're a Jeb Bush who, I don't know, 5-10 years ago would have been in the precise center of the Republican Party and with a last name, a brand that was worth a lot 5-10 years ago. Now the party's moved to the right, and you just look at national polls where he's got very high negatives that, frankly, I think it has nothing to do with him or his tenure as governor of Florida and a lot to do with sort of the aftermath of his brother's administration, not his father. Mm-hmm. So I think the world of the guy, but I think he's got a very tough row to hoe if he decides to get in this thing.
Charlie Cook of the Cook Political Report a few weeks ago on this program. Donna Hoffman, how do you size up that? Not a very rosy picture that Charlie Cook paints for the Jeb Bush candidacy.
Well, I think Bush has to decide if he's going to run like Huntsman did in 2012 from, you know, the more moderate wing of the Republican Party, didn't move to the right in the primaries, stood on principle on a lot of things, and very few people, especially in the state of Iowa, looked at him. He didn't visit here much either. Or will he run like a Romney who, you know, conceivably had some of the same issue positions, at least at one point, that Huntsman did, but moved on those positions, especially in terms of Romney care versus Obamacare, in terms of some of the things that Romney had done as Massachusetts governor, a very, you know, fairly liberal state. And Romney moved and was able to get the nomination. So Bush has to decide how he's going to run in a primary in the Republican Party, and especially in the caucuses in Iowa, as to whether he's going to talk more in a more nuanced fashion about some of the stands that he's taken on policy issues, or if he's going to not really alter any of those to appeal to Iowa caucus goers.
Hans.
I think that I think Charlie Cook is a great guy, and he's got wonderful – if you ever look at Cook reports, they do great things. I think he's got it completely wrong here, though. I think that he's looking at voters. And voters, definitely you see that fluctuation between candidates, the jumping from Michelle Bachmann to Rick Perry to all these different choices that they had. But if you look at the elites, if you look at the donors in the campaign – they had overwhelmingly flocked to Mitt Romney, and no other candidate even comes close to establishing that kind of support from the beginning. So while the polls may fluctuate a lot, Romney consistently had this lead in elite donors, and I think that that's where he's got it wrong. Is you can look at the polls; they're going to shift, they're going to fluctuate between now and the Iowa caucuses in 2016. But look at the donors, and that's really going to give you a sense of who's actually going to win. And I think Bush has a heads up, has an advantage here. He has these connections through his family to elite donors, that's going to be a huge benefit for him.
River to River listeners, so what's your reaction to George Bush's announcement that he will explore a run for the presidency? Can you imagine another President Bush? 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Donna, you said he has to decide how he's going to run Iowa's the first big test of the primary season. An indication this last weekend, I think you'd agree, big news from Jeb Bush before this latest announcement. He announced that he would release 250,000 emails from his two terms as Florida's governor. He said there will be an e-book incorporating the emails. This is surprising, isn't it, in an era when candidates, we've come to know them as terrified of unscripted sound bites that appear and are picked up by journalists or tweeted out of context or put on Facebook to show candidates with their guards down. Now we have 250,000 emails that will be able to be combed through by journalists. What do you think, Donna, he signals with this?
I mean, he's trying to signal he's going to run and going to be a transparent candidate. So he's going to release these emails. He's going to let people dig through them. But people are very careful with their official emails in the electronic era. So in saying that, he's going to have looked at those previously. And no, there's no smoking guns or something like that there. But he can also signal to people that he's going to be transparent. He's going to be open and that is a quality that a lot of voters will want to value.
Laudable for sure. Will this candor be a risky move, Hans?
I think he's trying to get stuff out of the way. The saying is that the media will cover wins, announcements, and gotchas. And he's trying to get these gotchas out of the way so that they're down the road they're not as big of an effect. I mean, if you have a gaffe or something that comes up on your campaign, you want it as far away from the election day as possible, so it's not going to be a major weight on that individual, on the voters' minds. Mm-hmm. And so he's just trying to – I think he's doing his due diligence and trying to get this stuff out there so that there is, if there is anything that might come out, that it's available and it's cleared and the campaign can handle it and manage it. And so I think that this is a standard practice now. You saw Sarah Palin do this when she was considering running in 2008. And I think that you're going to see more and more of this as people try to get, you know, skeletons out of the closet and cleaned off and all that sort of stuff. So I think this is just that standard practice.
So perhaps lessons being learned from the last few election cycles.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I can even think back to 2000 when information came out about George W. Bush about this drunk driving incident in Maine when he was in his 20s, right? So campaigns want to get this stuff out as soon as possible so that if there might be any damage to their candidacy, they can tamp it down and explain it and make it not as much of a big deal on the minds of voters. And also, you know, separate themselves between the release of this information and the time when voters are actually deciding.
This is a move that potentially sets up a 2016 battle. Of course, we're forecasting far into the future, which is very dangerous. But Jeb Bush against former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, whose husband, interestingly here, unseated Bush's father, George H.W. Bush, over 20 years ago. a potential clash between two of the biggest political dynasties in American history, the heir of a family feud, perhaps. I wonder if we would compare the strategies between Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush in their respective primaries. What would you have to say to that, Donna?
You know, I don't know in terms of, I mean, Hillary Clinton hasn't said she's in, Bush hasn't said he's in yet, but in terms of how they go about running, I mean, one of the things that, that dynasties can oftentimes tap into is nostalgia, nostalgia for a happier time. So, you know, certainly with Hillary Clinton, even though, you know, we should recognize Bill Clinton was impeached by the House of Representatives, right now, Bill Clinton looks really good. And part of that is in terms of his, the economic record of when he served in office. And so she can tap into, you know, she was instrumental in terms of the administration in her own right. She served in the Obama administration as Secretary of State. And so she can certainly talk about the experience that she's had at the national level. Bush can talk about a different kind of level of experience at a state level. And we certainly know that voters tend to look at candidates who've had executive experience. They tend to like that kind of experience in terms of how they decide who to vote for. And so, I mean, they'll both focus on their experience. And, you know, in some ways they'll, and especially in Bush's case, he'll have to carefully weigh how much he wants to tap into the George W. Bush legacy, because, you know, George W. Bush is, we're not that far removed from his presidency. It doesn't have that rosy glow that it might get down the road later. And, you know, Bush left office being seen as a big government conservative. And that is something that factored into the rise of the Tea Party. And so Jeb Bush has, because he's closer to that, to people's recollection of the Bush dynasty, has to distance himself, I think, a little bit from that and talk about how he will govern. Would it be in the model of a big government conservative? Because certainly he's not the favorite of the Tea Party faction within the party. I think it's much less powerful than it was, in the 2010 midterm cycle.
It's interesting, too, isn't it, that the Bush and Clinton families have, in the meantime, become close since either one of them occupied the White House. Bill Clinton has made a habit of visiting George H.W. Bush at his home in Maine every summer. Jeb Bush literally presented Hillary Clinton with an award. Here it is in September 2013, Jeb Bush presenting Hillary Clinton with the 2013 Liberty Medal at the National Constitution Center. He made a joke early on in his remarks about a possible 2016 run.
Hillary and I come from different political parties, and we disagree about a few things, but we do agree on the wisdom of the American people, especially those in Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina.
Okay, a little foreshadowing there. Also interesting, George W. Bush calls Bill Clinton famously his brother from another mother. What are your thoughts here, Hans?
I'm looking forward to a 2036 run between Chelsea and one of the Bush twins. Personally, I think that's going to be a great race. I think people once they're out of office, it's much easier to be friends and I think that that's one of the wonderful things about America is that once we move beyond partisan politics, there's a lot in common between a lot of us. And I think that what they're finding is that they can agree and work towards mutual benefits. And I think that's great. I think that's a sign of a good democracy that we do have, that people can put aside differences to work together on things that they can mutually agree on. That rancor is not going to spread over into other aspects of life.
Hans Hassel, you recently wrote an article for The Washington Post titled How Political Parties Clear the Field in Primaries, an article in which you wrote about how parties not only determine who will win the nomination, but shape the field. Tell us the essence of that. What work is being done behind the scenes? We talked a little bit about it in the primary campaign.
It's a coordination game. I mean, it's like if you want to go to a restaurant and you want to go to a good restaurant, but you also want to have a lot of your friends there, right? You want to identify which is the best restaurant. What you have is a lot of donors trying to figure out, okay, which is the candidate that's going to give us the best way to give us the best food. Which one is the one that's going to provide us with the highest chance of winning the general election? And you've got lots of different options. You've got a Christie restaurant, you've got a Jeb Bush restaurant, you've got a Mitt Romney restaurant, you've got a Bobby Jindal restaurant. All these different options are out there. Well, how do you coordinate with your friends? You've got thousands of donors here, thousands of people that are in this party elite. that are well connected to the party, are interested in winning seats, winning the presidency. Right? How do you coordinate between yourselves? Well, part of this is communication. Part of this is picking something salient in the network. And what I found is that party donor, as a candidate gets more and more of the share of the party connected donors in a race, I'm looking here at Senate races. A candidate is much more likely to do well in the primary, and is also much less likely to drop out of the primary. Party candidates or candidates that received a smaller share of the party connected donors were more likely to withdraw from a primary prior to the primary being run. These candidates realize, I think, that they're not going to get the party support. They're not going to be able to get capable staff members to run their campaigns. They're not going to get the resources from the party that they would like. And so they say, well, wait a second. Rather than tick a whole bunch of people off that I'm going to need later if I run for another office, I think I'll just run for another office now or wait for my turn in line or go do something else where I can be helpful and constructive and perhaps bide my time for a future run.
Do we know at this point, both of you, I'd like your opinion, is Jeb Bush, do you think, considered the preferred candidate of the big GOP donors? Do we know that answer to that question yet, Hans?
I don't think so. I think that there are lots of good options. You saw recently in the New York Times there was a report that some political donors were trying to coordinate, trying to start a coordination, an effort to coordinate donors on a particular candidate. But I think the fact that we're talking about this means that it hasn't been done yet.
Mm-hmm. Donna, you weigh in on that, please?
Right, and they'll hang back a little bit to see what the prospects are and who's in and who's out as well.
Okay, let's go to Helen in Ames joining our conversation on this Politics Wednesday, 1-866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public Radio on our Facebook page. Helen has called us from Ames. Hi, Helen. What do you want to chip in?
Yes, I would like to hear your guests talk about the Democratic Party a little here. Bernie Sanders has been in and out of Iowa. He was here yesterday with way over 200 people at a rally or a town meeting. And there is some dissension taking place in the Democratic Party, also wanting to go a little more progressive direction. So what would your guests have to say about that?
Helen, excellent question. Let's talk about that. The rise of Elizabeth Warren being reported on in recent days. What do you see in that, Donna Hoffman, changing the way Hillary will run if she runs?
Potentially. You know, I would note that it was a couple of weeks ago, former Senator Jim Webb announced he was forming an exploratory committee. And that didn't make a whole lot of news. It certainly isn't making the amount of news of Jeb Bush that we're talking about today. But there are other Democrats that are looking at challenging a potential, Hillary Clinton run. And we should always remember that in 2008, she was the perceived front runner and she did not end up winning the nomination. So you do have Bernie Sanders, who's, not only was he in Des Moines earlier, as the caller mentioned, but, he's been in Waterloo about a month ago. And Elizabeth Warren is certainly seen as being someone that a lot of her supporters want to draft. And she pretty forcefully this week, said, I'm not considering a run. But, stranger things have happened, certainly. And again, the Democratic field will be shaped by what Hillary Clinton decides. And so there will be some people. Martin O'Malley is another one that has visited Iowa a lot in the run-up to the midterm elections, who's, seen as being a Clinton ally and wouldn't be in if she was in, but, might be running for vice president, for example. And so a lot of those decisions are going to be made based on what Hillary Clinton says and does.
Okay. Donna Hoffman is with us on this Politics Wednesday, department head and associate professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. She's in our Cedar Falls studio, scholar of presidential politics. Hans Hassel is with us, assistant professor of politics at Cornell College, also lending us his insights and expertise as we pick apart the latest political developments nationally and here in the state. When we come back, we want to continue talking about Jeb Bush's announcement to explore the possibility of running for the presidency. Also, we want to talk about the legacies of the members of Congress who will not be in the next Congress from Iowa. Of course, Senator Harkin, Tom Latham, and Bruce Braley. That's when we return. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Hunters, you will want to tune in tomorrow over the noon hour. We're in the middle of toward the end of the deer hunting season, the latest deer hunting season. I believe it ends on Sunday. We're going to talk about deer hunting in Iowa. Also, the problem of poaching here in Iowa tomorrow on the program. Today it's Politics Wednesday. We're talking about, as we like to do, political developments within the last few days. Yesterday, Jeb Bush announced that he would form a political action committee, allowing him to explore a possible White House bid. We've been talking about that as we get each week closer to the Iowa caucuses, which is just over a year from now. 1-866-780-9100. I want to talk about the legacies of the members of Congress from Iowa who will no longer be in the next Congress in a few minutes. But let's go to Tom in Des Moines. Tom, welcome to our program. We have our guests, Hans Hassel of Cornell College and Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa. Welcome, Tom.
Well, thanks for taking my call. I had just one simple question in the complex nature of the Iowa caucus process. It's a party-run event run by the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. Bernie Sanders, Senator Sanders from Vermont, is an independent. How does he technically function within that context, or is he just setting the stage for an independent run in the as a progressive, as John Anderson ran as an independent and Ross Perot ran as an independent back in the previous time?
Tom, fascinating question. Let's. I think Hans may have an answer for you. Can you run as an independent in a Democratic Party's caucus?
You can, actually. Party registration is done by state. So some states don't have party registration. Minnesota, for example, up north doesn't have party registration. So when you register to vote, you don't check off a specific party. So if you think about it, none of the political candidates, unless you're an Iowan, actually have registration as, with a particular party in Iowa. And so what you do essentially is just say, okay, I want to run for the nomination of this particular party. You go through the registration process, and that varies by, from state to state, whether that's getting a certain number of signatures or getting paying a filing fee, and you're on the ballot for that particular race. So you could be a Republican from Iowa or from Iowa and run in the New Hampshire Democratic primary. Right? It doesn't matter as long as you've met the requirements and filed the registration papers. Mm-hmm. So I mean it's an artifact of how individual states deal with party registration.
Tom, excellent question from Des Moines. Thank you. Let's talk a little bit about the news. The straw poll, traditionally prior to the Iowa caucuses. More news today, Donna Hoffman, this week, as a matter of fact, Governor Brandt said, saying he would support a statewide Republican fundraising event in Ames in the summer, where GOP presidential hopefuls are invited to speak as long as there is no vote taken. And this has been the practice during past straw polls. That's been the focus of the controversy. Give us some background here, Donna Hoffman, on the Iowa straw poll. What is the controversy surrounding it?
Well, it's, you know, at its root, it's a fundraising event for the Iowa Republican Party. And if you've ever been to Ames in August in the year before a presidential election, then it's a big circus. It's a big event. Candidates have to buy their prime location on campus. And so they bid on that. They pay money to the party to get the best spot. They have to have entertainment. They have to have food. They, in fact, buy people who come to the event. They don't have to be Republicans. They can be anybody. They do have to be Iowans these days. That wasn't even a criteria in some of the earlier ones. But the campaigns themselves will buy the tickets. It's $25 to $30, depending on the year. That a voter, a quote-unquote voter, a participant in the straw poll, has to buy in order to cast a ballot, if you will. And the campaigns themselves commit to buying certain number of tickets and passing them out to their supporters so that their supporters can go vote for them. The national media shows up in droves because this is seen as being a test of organizational strength in the state. But at its root, it's a fundraiser for the Republican Party. And, one of the reasons why the national media shows up is because they want something, you know, they want more. They like the horse race aspect in terms of reporting and who's ahead in Iowa and who's behind in Iowa. And so they can come to this event and get some kind of a gauge, a straw poll that's easily reportable to the public. And so that's kind of the background on this. And after the last straw poll in 2011, Branstad was critical of it and said that he thought it had outlived its usefulness. Michelle Bachmann won the straw poll in August of 2011, and Ron Paul came in second, just barely. And so there has been this debate about whether the party would do that. And so there seems to be kind of differing opinions within the party about whether to go forward with the event. actually having some kind of a balancing entity. And Branstad now is at least in favor of an event, but not having the poll aspect of that, where there's other people within the Republican Party that want to maintain the straw poll aspect.
Mm-hmm. How much does the straw poll, has it traditionally indicated? You mentioned Michelle Bachmann and Ron Paul. How much does it indicate their real strength, Hans?
Well, I think this is a power dynamic between two parts of the party, right? You've got the grassroots that has in the past, shown very favorably towards candidates such as Bachmann or more conservative candidates. And then you've got the more mainstream moderate Republicans that say, well, this is reflecting poorly on our party if we have this straw poll and we support someone like Michelle Bachmann who doesn't eventually even compete for the nomination. She ran a couple of primaries but really didn't have a whole lot of influence. And so I think that this is a struggle for power. Those on the far right say, well, this is an opportunity for us to get more press coverage and to raise our salience within the party. And I think that what you're seeing here is just a struggle between the two entities. One of them views this as very useful for advancing their ideas and their candidates, and the other says, wait a second, we're causing a divide here with our eventual nominee, showing some weaknesses, and that may not be best for the party if the end goal is to win elections.
Hans Hassel is with us, assistant professor of politics at Cornell College. Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, where she's department head and associate professor of political science. Let's talk in the remaining minutes about the members of Congress who will no longer be with us in the Congress, that is, in 2015. Of course, first and foremost, a lot of attention given to Senator Harkin, who is retiring after a 40-year congressional career. Let's listen to his farewell speech last Friday on the Senate floor. In the address, he addressed the need for government to give access to the first rung of the ladder of success and went on to mention his work toward equality for those with disabilities.
35 years ago, we looked around America and we saw millions of people that no matter how hard they tried, could never climb that ladder of success. No matter how hard they tried, could never do it. These were our fellow Americans, our brothers and sisters with disabilities. So what did government do? We built them a ramp, and we called it the Americans with Disabilities Act. Now again, we didn't build a moving walkway, did we? See, with a ramp, you still have to exert energy and initiative to get up. I've often said there's not one dime, not one nickel in the Americans with Disabilities Act given to a person with a disability. What we did is we broke down the barriers. We opened the doors of accessibility and accommodation, and we said to people with disabilities, now go on, follow your dreams. And in the words of the Army motto, be all you can be.
Tom Harkin in his farewell speech last Friday. Hans Hassel, that has to be his number one accomplishment, what he'll be known for, his legacy?
Absolutely. I appreciate you playing that. I hadn't heard all of that, and that's a very moving speech. And I think that that really is one of the things that he really worked hard for over the course of his tenure as senator. He viewed that as important, and I think that he's made a definite impact on those individuals that have really had doors open for them because of it.
Let's listen to another bit from that farewell speech. Tom Harkin honored his longtime fellow Iowan in that speech, Senator Chuck Grassley.
So I came to Congress, the House, in 1974 as one of the Watergate babies. Among all the Democrats elected in that landslide year of 1974, there were a few Republicans, and one is left. My senior colleague from the state of Iowa, Senator Chuck Grassley. I have the greatest respect for and friendship with Chuck. Several weeks ago, here on the floor, he said some very gracious things about me, and I thank him for that. I especially appreciated his observation, though, that even though he and I are like night and day when it comes to political views, there's no light between us when it comes to Iowa. We have collaborated on so many important initiatives for the people of Iowa, and I think we made a heck of a good tag team on behalf of our state. So again, I salute and thank my friend and colleague of nearly 40 years, Chuck Grassley. Carry on, Chuck.
Tom Harkin in his farewell speech, honoring his longtime fellow Iowan Senator, Senior Senator Chuck Grassley. Donna Hoffman, really the end of an era, and we hear it in Tom Harkin's voice there. This has been so, these two senators together have been such a part of Iowa's political profile nationally.
Yes, they really have. And you know, one of the things that that I want to point out about Harkin is that he's always a lot of people from out of the state have over the years pointed to him as being significant in terms of political representation for them because of his populist views. And so, you know, one of the things that Harkin pioneered in Congress was this concept of work days. And this was something that he could, you know, both use as a member of Congress, but also, you know, could help him keep touch with people and help his reelection as well. But he would go out and do a job, just a regular job for a day. And other people started to kind of copy that. And so he very much was seen, and when he ran for president in 1992, he really took a populist kind of bent to that in terms of, you know, his rights for the disabled, as we talked about. But also, you know, more recently, he's really pushed for raising the minimum wage to $10.10. He's been, as a member of the Iowa delegation, very active in the passage of several farm bills, and he headed that committee at some critical times as well. And so he's really kind of this icon. And again, also with Chuck Grassley, they've both been icons in the Senate, and now we'll just have Grassley left.
Also leaving Congress, Tom Latham, he's retiring. He is gave his farewell speech on the floor of the House recently, and in it he references the wide part of Iowa that he's represented.
I've represented a lot of the state, having the different districts, starting with the 5th District, then the 4th District, now the 3rd District, moving from Northwest Iowa to Northeast Iowa to Southwest Iowa. But it is the honor of my life to serve the people of Iowa and have that that opportunity to be their representative in Washington to try to accomplish things for their good, for the good of the country. And again, just to say thank you.
Okay, Tom Latham in his farewell speech. Donna, can you tack on some things we'll remember about Tom Latham and his goes back to the 90s is when he was first elected, I believe.
Yeah, he was. Like Harkin was elected in the Watergate wave he talked about in 1974. Latham was elected in 1994, the Republican wave of that year when Republicans took over both the House and the Senate. And Latham, you know, I would characterize him really as a workhorse and not a show horse. He's not a flashy kind of guy. He doesn't go out and seek the television cameras. But he is fairly quiet, but he's also fairly influential. Very early on, he formed a friendship with John Boehner. John Boehner, of course, now Speaker of the House. And that's been kind of an influential friendship, I think. And Latham also served on the Appropriations Committee, and that's a committee in which a member can really look out for the people of their state by bringing home pork, as oftentimes we call it, earmarks. Which he's been able to do until there was a moratorium placed on those relatively recently. But nevertheless, he's really worked for his constituents, as he mentioned, in multiple counties of Iowa as his district shifted. I think it was a bit of a surprise to some people that he passed on running for Harkin's seat in the 2014 election. But of course he did. And then he even surprised people further by deciding to retire. And, you know, now he's giving his farewell address.
Okay. And one name we have to mention, not voluntarily retiring from Congress, Iowa's Democratic U.S. Senate hopeful Bruce Braley, 8-year congressman from Waterloo, lost by 8.5 points this past election to Joni Ernst, the Republican state senator from Red Oak. Here is a bit of Bruce Braley's concession speech, I believe, the night of the election late in the night.
This is not a bad day for Bruce Braley. This is a day to celebrate what people can do together when they put their mind to it, they work hard, and they try to change the way people think about their relationship to their government and to their future. So my biggest fear is that all of the great young Democratic activists that I've met on this campaign are going to be frustrated about what happened tonight. That would be the worst outcome of this disappointment. You have the power to change lives and to change the future of this country. Tonight is the starting point of the rest of your life and the opportunity to make your mark on this state and this country.
Bruce Braley in his concession speech after the midterm election. Hans, give us a little bit of what you will remember the eight-year congressman from Waterloo for.
Well, to tell you the truth, I've only lived here in Iowa for about 3 years now as I came to Cornell. But one of the things I've noticed recently about Braley is that he's a much better campaigner than I think we give him credit for. A lot of people recently have been saying that he had the worst campaign, that he ran really, really poorly.
Yes.
I think that that's a little over-exaggerated. I think he's actually a very good campaigner. He just was up against a very, very difficult headwind. You look at Obama's approval ratings in Iowa compared to other similar states, and they're much lower. I think that the economy and a variety of other things conspired against him in this particular race, and he didn't get a whole lot of help from people like Harkin and other Democrats that he really could have used that help. And I think that as a result, he performed below what we would have expected. But I think looking back, I think he performed at expectations, or perhaps even better than we would have thought, given the environment that he was facing.
Mm-hmm. Donna Hoffman, you agree that Bruce Braley's perhaps his accomplishments in 8 years being overshadowed by the way in which he is exiting Congress.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And you know, if you read congressional biographies of Bruce Braley, they'll talk about him being articulate, about him being a trial lawyer, about him being ambitious. And, you know, he has for a number of years been seen as a rising star in the House, in the Democratic Party. And I don't think we've probably heard the last of him. And he could go on to run for other offices. Right. It remains to be seen what his plans are. But certainly he put in a lot of time in the House working for the party and was a good and faithful member in that respect.
Mm-hmm. And certainly there are plenty of examples of politicians who've been soundly defeated earlier on in their careers only to come back.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. One of the things I thought was really interesting is you talk about Latham's style of representation and Braley's style of representation. Mm-hmm. They're very different, right? Donna, you talked about Latham as a workhorse. And perhaps Braley's is more of a show horse. They're both doing good things for their constituents, but they're going about it in different ways. And I think that's one of the most unique things about these retirements is that you look at these individuals and say both of these people had very successful careers. They were members of the House for a long time, but they went about it doing it in a different ways. And I think part of that is their representational style and their preferences. And part of it is what are their goals? What are their aspirations? Right? I think that you look at Latham declining to run for the Senate. He was very content working hard. Braley is someone that has a lot more ambition. I think that it's very interesting to me to look at both these Congress and say they're both leaving at the same time. They're leaving for different reasons, and they had very, very different careers.
Mm-hmm. I want to get your reaction to the campaign that Bruce Braley ran, Donna Hoffman. This is from the Washington Post politics writer, Chris Saliza, I believe is the way you say his name. He's over 200,000 Twitter followers. But he put Braley as the absolute worst from his list of 10 nominees for candidates in this past election. To quote him, Braley, who through sheer force of personality not only lost a very winnable open seat race, but lost it badly. Some races are a failure of the campaign. This was a failure of the candidate, according to this writer for the Washington Post. What is your view on that, Donna?
I think I'd go back to what Hans said earlier. You know, he doesn't get as much credit as he probably needs in terms of the way that the campaign went. And he was tackling some, you know, very large headwinds in terms of the state. There's a lot of emphasis, and I think that particular article also talks about the gaffe where he was captured on tape, you know, talking about Grassley being the head of the Judiciary Committee. A non-lawyer, a farmer from Iowa, and that was seen as being, you know, this pivotal thing. And certainly I wouldn't say that was unimportant, but it wasn't the single thing that the election turned on. And I think there's a tendency many times, especially of pundits, to make a defeat, especially in this manner, in a race in which it was winnable by Braley, but it was winnable by Joni Ernst, too. and because it was a battleground and the control of the Senate potentially hinged on that. And I think there's, you know, sometimes a tendency of pundits to say, yeah, it was that one event that, you know, it just all went downhill from there. And that's oversimplifying it.
Mm-hmm. But in terms of campaign ads, do you see, Hans, something lacking there if we can put something on that?
I think we put too much emphasis on campaign ads and,
yes,
and actual campaign actions. Right? I think things to cover.
But wouldn't Joni Ernst's campaign say it was the pork ad that won that campaign or put her on a winning path?
Very early on, you can make a slight difference. Whether or not those differences carry over a long term, right? You can raise your visibility for short periods of time. But I think that to say, oh, this campaign was won back in April with the
make 'em squeal ad,
right? I think that that's a little bit too much, and I think that we put too much emphasis on things that most voters aren't actually paying attention to. Right? A lot of people don't see these campaign ads. A lot of people never heard about these gaffes. And so a lot of this information, I think, is they're evaluating on other aspects. And I think that we make a little bit too much out of this than we probably should.
Okay. Hans Hassel, Assistant Professor of Politics at Cornell College. Donna Hoffman, Department Head and Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Thank you both so much for some tremendous insights this hour.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
A pleasure. And thank you for coming into our studio. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Lindsay Moon, and Emily Woodbury. Cedar Falls, we had help from Tony Daner. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow, we talk about hunting on this program, also the problem and prevalence of poaching in our state. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.